So hi everyone. Everyone keeping cool? It's all warm here. So this is the first of four classes that we'll be doing on the Yoga Sutra. And this course, these four classes, constitute a course in a series of courses that we're calling the Middle Way Center courses. And so each one of these classes are self-sustained. So if you can only drop in for one or several, that's fine. But if you're interested in doing the whole course, they also will, kind of unfold sequentially. We'll try to do a review for every class so that, we all remember what happened already before we do new stuff. And then there are exercises that are appended to each class. And so ideally, a course like this would be taught over 4 weeks, one class per week. We're doing four classes in 2 days. So my suggestion is that if you want to, kind of really get the juice out of a course like this, that number one, you do the exercise, and number two, you do the exercise for each class for a week. So in other words, this would be a four-week course done in 2 days. So I mean, we'll do each of the classes in these 2 days, but then you take it home. And the exercises are very, they're very experiential. The courses are all meant to bring the ancient wisdom of mostly India and Southern Tibet into your daily life, so that it makes some change in your daily life. If you're, you come to these classes, one or all four of them, and just kind of, listen for an hour and a half, and then, go home without doing any kind of exercise, nothing much is going to change for you. Nothing much is going to, affect your life. It'll just be another, experience, like watching a television show. And the way that, the information bombardment that we're under, we are accustomed to having things go in one ear and out the other because we can't retain it all. It's just so much information. And so I encourage you not to take a course like this with that kind of attitude of just sort of like a semi-entertaining experience. There's probably a lot more entertaining experiences that you could have in Austin. On a Monday or Tuesday night. Even on a Monday or Tuesday night, there's, 30 or 40 live bands playing. And so it's not entertainment, It's meant to be transformational. And it's meant to be knowledge, or you could even say wisdom, that would work a change on your inner life and your experience of your life. Of the world around you and of other people and so forth. So with that kind of attitude, we come to these classic texts, and the Yoga Sutra, which is the text that we'll be dealing with in this course, has come to be a classic text. Yoga means yoga. Everyone know what yoga means, right? I bet you don't. What's the deeper meaning of yoga? What's the sort of this? The the Sanskrit word, but what does it literally mean? Anyone know? Union, union or connection, joining. The word join in English, is related to the Sanskrit word yoga. The word yoke, yoke, not the yoke in your aids, but the yoke like you put on an oxen, is related to the word yoga. Also, Sanskrit and English are related languages. English. Obviously, is derives from Sanskrit. So anyway, yoga means union, and then sutra means aphorism. Aphorism. Everyone know what aphorism means? Short, succinct, kind of statement. And so the Yoga Sutra is a very difficult text to understand because it is a sutra. There, I think, are only I can't remember exactly. Maybe only as few as one or two verbs in the whole text, in four chapters. So it's just these very, very succinct, kind of three, four word, kind of like bombardments. Sometimes they're a little longer than that. And uh, to tr- to you can't understand the Yoga Sutra without a commentary. You just can't. It doesn't make any sense. And so there's lots and lots of commentaries on the Yoga Sutra at this point. There's been a commentarial tradition probably since the very origin of the Yoga Sutra. Yoga Sutra was written by a teacher named Patanjali, and the original commentary was supposedly written by a scholar named Vyasa in Sanskrit. But modern scholarship suggests that Vyasa was just a pen name that Patanjali himself used. So he wrote what they call an auto-commentary, it seems like. And then there are like countless commentaries, you know, after that in the Sanskrit tradition. And now, of course, in the modern Western world, there's countless commentaries written in English and other European languages on the Yoga Sutra. So the Yoga Sutra is a very interesting text. I'm not approaching this text from an academic point of view, but I can't help it a little bit, having been an academic all my life, to just point out a couple of facts that the academic world sort of thinks they know about the Yoga Sutra. And the most important of them is that the Yoga Sutra was written probably in 400 AD, around then, and became sort of popular by the 9th century. And then several centuries went by, 5-6 centuries went by, where gradually, nobody paid any attention to this text. Until the 16th century, it was practically, it was hardly extant. They weren't copying the manuscripts anymore, which is how they passed on texts anymore, because nobody cared about it. And so there was this long period, right up until about the 19th or 20th century, where the Yoga Sutra wasn't a classic. It wasn't a classic even in India. And then it was majorly rediscovered, as recently, you could say, as about 40 or 50 years ago. And has become a classic. It's become a modern classic. You could say that the Western interest, it's really, kind of worldwide now. The worldwide interest in yoga reinvented the Yoga Sutra as a classic. Just kind of FYI, this isn't, the Bhagavad Gita is sort of similar in this regard historically. Amazing text, and we all kind of look, those of you who know the Bhagavad Gita come to it and think, this is obviously a classic, but it was also not a terribly popular text until fairly recently. You could argue that Mahatma Gandhi put the Bhagavad Gita on the map. It was one of his favorite texts, and he learned the Bhagavad Gita in England, not in India, in an English translation. So the world is a small place. And there's lots and lots of influences now. So the translation of the Yoga Sutra is my own, and the interpretation of the Yoga Sutra that I'll offer to you guys is also my own. It's not linked to any one of the commentarial traditions. There are so many of them, for one thing. And, I'm informed by some of them. I know something about, both the Sanskrit commentarial traditions and especially the English ones now. But the interpretation is my own. And I think that we should come up. I'm not going to be teaching it, as an academic text, from an academic point of view. I'm going to want to teach it from a practical point of view. How does this text, how can we understand this text as a kind of a guidebook to practice, to our spiritual practice? And that's just a choice, There are other interpretations of the Yoga Sutra that would emphasize much more of the philosophical nature, the traditional philosophical nature of the Yoga Sutra, the Sankhya philosophy. Yoga and Sankhya, are two of the six main schools of Hindu philosophy. So, they're often linked. The Sankhya, the Sankhya philosophy is dualist, basically. Understanding two principles, spirit and matter, as kind of like, if you wanted to put it that way in English. So you could go that way with it. There are Advaita Vedanta interpretations of the Yoga Sutra. Shankara wrote a commentary on the Yoga Sutra. You could go that way you know, and understand it from the point of view of Advaita Vedanta is the, you know, all is one, you know, that kind of a monistic philosophy. But I'm interested nowadays in any of these texts, not for like, you know, academic reasons or historical reasons or which lineage, you know, they represent or how, which lineage you belong to, you know, understand it in one way or another. But how does it like inform our lives? How can we use this text as a guidebook to change our lives, to understand our lives, to change our lives? So hopefully it'll be a very practical, you know, understanding of the Yoga Sutra. You know, from my own best understanding of what the Yoga Sutra is saying about how we could practice, you know, how we could integrate the text, the teachings in the Yoga Sutra into our daily lives. And I think you'll see that especially the verses I've selected, we can't do all of them. We don't have time to do a whole like verse by verse like you know, analysis. But the verses that I've picked out, you know, center around three elements of a practice, and they are three elements that you can find, I think, pretty much in any authentic practice, spiritual practice. The first one is a physical element, physical. And that very much includes ethics. You know, we'll see in the Yoga Sutra they call it yamas and niyamas, the restraints and the precepts. You could translate. So physical practice doesn't, you know, especially when you come to a text like Yoga Sutra, you might assume, well, physical practice means just doing asanas all the time. And there are two or three verses in the whole of the Yoga Sutra that deal with asana. It's a rather minor point in the text. It's about how to live a life entirely. It's about, you know, it's a worldview. It's how to understand your life and the world and how things are working and so forth. And that was the original intent of yoga. That was really what yoga was all about. This whole emphasis on asana is very recent. Very, very recent. Especially any kind of emphasis on aerobic asana. You know, that's within the last couple of decades, really. And so anyway, the tradition of yoga was a philosophy. That's how it came down for centuries and centuries, as one of the six great schools of philosophy in India. So a physical dimension can include asana, of course, can include the physical postures of yoga, but also include everything that we do with our bodies, including, like, you know, how we interact with other people in the world with our bodies. And so ethics very much plays a part in that first dimension of a practice. Then the second dimension is meditation. And there's a great deal in the Yoga Sutra about meditation, as we will see. And again, this is common. You know, meditation is a translation into English of a whole bunch of Sanskrit words. There's probably maybe as many as 8 or 10 Sanskrit words that we have like one English translation for, one English equivalent for. You know, I grew up in Minnesota, and I always heard these stories about how the Eskimos had like 20 different names for snow. You know, all the different kinds of snow. And it seems like in the Indian tradition, the Sanskrit Indian tradition, they have that same kind of richness of vocabulary when it came to meditation, what we just call meditation. But every authentic spiritual tradition has some form of meditation included in their practice. You know, in the Western traditions, they tend to call it, you know, contemplation or prayer. But, you know, everyone has like some idea that's important to kind of like get quiet and to kind of go into your own mind and commune with something, you know, in there. You know, everyone has some sense of that. Every tradition. So that's the second one, meditation. And, you know, some form of meditation should be included in everyone's practice. You know, and it can be very formal. It can, you know, you can learn meditation techniques now practically anywhere. There's lots and lots of it out there now. And so, you know, you can learn it formally and buy some expensive cushions and stuff like that and sit there every morning and do meditation. Or you can incorporate some quiet time in your day to just stop and, you know, kind of like take some deep breaths and close your eyes and think about the meaning of life. Or think about, like, you know, how's it going in my life? Just stop once in a while. And that's a form of meditation too. This thing that they call mindfulness nowadays is just a form of, you know, kind of ongoing meditation. Really. It's having a meditative mindset as you're going through the day. And basically it means paying attention. Paying attention to what's happened. You know. Mindfulness is going to be a big industry. And I gave a talk once fairly recently to a group of executives at the Standard Chartered Bank in Singapore. 50 executives. And I told them, you know, like, mindfulness is happening. You'll probably be hiring mindfulness advisors, you know, pretty soon, paying them all kinds of money to come to, you know, your corporation to teach the execs mindfulness. I'll tell you for free what mindfulness is. You know, just pay attention to what's happening here and now. That's the essence of it. And then, you know, you can fancy it all up and make it into like some kind of like major technique and, you know, kind of like charge people a lot of money, but it just comes to that. What's going on now, here and now? So meditation is the second part. Practice, some kind of physical practice, including ethics. Meditation, then the third major component, and these are all found in the Yoga Sutra, and there should be this component in any complete practice. Wisdom. Wisdom. And wisdom isn't data collecting. Okay? Wisdom isn't just the accumulation of facts. That's never been the understanding of wisdom in, you know, in India for sure, and in any world religion. If wisdom means an understanding, a deep understanding that changes you, that transforms you, not just in your head, but in your very being, in the core of your being. And what's always entailed when it comes to wisdom is that things are not what they appear to be. There's a deeper level of reality than just the obvious one. If there weren't, you wouldn't need wisdom. You see, if there weren't something deeper than just what appears to us with our senses, or how we ordinarily understand the world. If there was one, you wouldn't need any, you know, have no need for wisdom at all. But wisdom always entails the notion that there is a deeper level of reality below the surface of things. And the Yoga Sutra definitely goes into that. As should any authentic practice, you know. Okay, so those three. Some physical component, including ethics. Some meditative component and a wisdom component. And then you have a more or less of a complete practice. And for those of you who are trained in Buddhism, these are called the three trainings. Right? In Buddhism, they call them the three trainings. And in other forms of Buddhism, they call them the Eightfold Path, which can be, you know, categorized into three parts. The eight can go into three. So you find it in Buddhism, you find it in the Hindu tradition, you find it in, I would say you would find it in Christianity and Judaism and Islam. Those three components, right? And you find them everywhere. So we'll be looking at those three components, you know, in the Yoga Sutra. So we should start, I think. Because, you know, I did select only some of the verses, but I selected kind of a lot. Because I couldn't help it. So we'll begin. This is class one, the meaning and purpose of yoga. Oh, and by the way, one more thing. There's a lot of, like, speculation about what you're joining in yoga. What's the union that they're talking about? And I would just like to offer one of the many possibilities here that you will see in the text, actually. Yoga is about union with your true nature, with who you really are. With your svarupa, your own form, your own true form, your own true self. The Atman, sometimes they call it, or Purusha in this text. Purusha means the person, the sort of cosmic person that we all are, deep down. Union with who you really are. And we'll see, that's the goal of yoga. That's another word for that in the yoga text. There's a lot of, I'm saying a lot of Sanskrit, is it okay? Following on it? I don't have a whiteboard here, and you don't need one, I don't think.
There's one there.
Oh, there is. Do I need to write all this down? No, all right, good. Another word for yoga, you know, in the Yoga Sutra is samadhi. Samadhi. And that's the eighth of the eightfold yogic path that we'll start talking about tonight, I think, or tomorrow, I can't remember. Samadhi is the goal of yoga. And samadhi means, I've translated it, complete integration. Complete integration. So it's the same thing as yoga. Union is a complete integration, right? So a complete integration with what? And again, you could say, with your true nature. Or with reality as it really is. To truly integrate with reality. You know, kind of both inner and outer. Reality of who you really are. And reality as it is, in as you experience it in life. And that's the goal of yoga. So we'll see. So here we go. These are verses from chapter 1, mostly in this class, which is sometimes called Samadhipada. I just talked about Samadhi. Samadhipada means chapter. Samadhi means this integration, complete integration. Atha yoga anushasanam. First verse. And now for some yoga. And now for some stuff about yoga. Anushasanam doesn't mean some stuff about it, actually. Anushasana means authoritative teaching. And now for an authoritative teaching on yoga. Anushasana. So, what does he mean by this? What does he mean by authoritative? And, you know, I don't know what Patanjali meant, you know, exactly. He probably meant something like, here's what I learned about yoga from my teacher. And that's why it's authoritative. It's because I heard it from my guru. And that's usually how it's understood in India. You know, I heard it from my guru. And then the question is, well, who taught your guru? Right? And then the guru, well, the guru probably had a guru too. So there is this thing called parampara in Sanskrit. Parampara, from one to another, from one mouth to an ear, and then from another mouth to another ear, like that. A transmission, a lineage, like that. But lineages are complicated things. There's this kind of like phrase in English that sometimes people grasp a hold of. Pure and unbroken lineage. Pure and unbroken lineage. And that's a myth, okay? That's a kind of a fancy way of saying irrelevant. Pure and unbroken lineage. You know. Things change. Things change. Understandings of things change. Right? If it were just repetition, over and over and over again. Well, I can't say anything new about the Yoga Sutra because my teacher taught it this way and his teacher taught it that way and her teacher taught it that way and so forth. It was just repetition. It would never change and it would be irrelevant. Because, you know, Yoga Sutra is 1700 years old from India. How is it going to be relevant to us in this day and age? You see, it has to change. And it has always changed, of course. If you look at most of these sort of religious lineages, they're not only like impure in the sense that they've always been changing. You see? I don't even like to say it that way. It is pure because it does change. It's pure because it's continually made relevant to different audiences at different times and in different places. But, you know, people get this idea of purity as unchanging. That's not possible. Even if it were possible, it would render these texts irrelevant. So, and unbroken is also kind of problematic when you deal with like long periods of time, where, for example, in the Yoga Sutra like was kind of unknown for 500, 600, 700 years. This is really a long time, you know. We think like a couple years is a long time. How about a couple centuries? So what does it mean, unbroken, pure and unbroken? So where's the authority? Where's the authority of any spiritual text? And I would suggest to you the authority comes from its efficacy. Does it work? Is it true? Does it point to some truth? And never mind about all of this kind of pseudo-historical, you know, parampara thing, you know, from one ear to the other. It doesn't matter, in a way. It doesn't matter at all. If it's not relevant, if it's not useful, if it's not utilitarian, why bother with it, you know? So the authority comes from us, actually. The authority of the text comes from the receiver of the text, not from the perpetrator of the text. The receiver says, this is either relevant to me or not. I find this useful or not, and therefore it is authoritative or not. What do you think? Anushasana. There's a lot of texts that in the Buddhist tradition that begin, this is what I heard. The Heart Sutra and the Diamond Cutter Sutra, this is what I heard. And that could be very, very different than what it was said. You know? It's kind of like built into some of these texts to say, look, you know, I don't know what the Buddha actually said, but here's what I heard. So already it's like, you know, the receiver, the reception is the important thing. And then you'll hear something different, right? So this is what I heard about the Yoga Sutra. Now I'll tell you about it, and you can decide what you heard. And that's how a kind of a lineage unfolds, actually. It's always filtered through the receiver of the text, from the hearer. Okay? So, yoga-citta vritti nirodha, second verse. This is probably the most important verse of the Yoga Sutra. And kind of the most complicated. I mean, there's four Sanskrit words here. There's yoga, there's citta, there's vritti, and there's nirodha. You wouldn't think it should be that complicated. Yoga is not complicated that much. Citta is not complicated either. Citta means mind. Mind. Nirodha is not complicated because nirodha means cessation, stopping something. The complicated thing is vritti. This is the definition of yoga in the Yoga Sutra. Yoga is the stopping the mind's vritti. And then the big debate is, well, what is vritti? Vritti literally means turning in Sanskrit. It means a turning. And so what is the turnings of the mind? I translated it here, habitual patterns of thought, which I kind of like. I'm behind that. You'd think that, right, since it's my translation. You could also translate it, I think, accurately, churning. Churning. Yoga is designed to stop the churnings of the mind. Anyone experience that in their own minds? The sort of obsessional going over and over again, over and over. So habitual patterns. And the stopping, nirodha, means that yoga is meant to get to a state of calm when it comes to your mind, to calm the mind, like a lake that's been all churned up by the wind or something like that. And then the wind stops and the lake becomes placid. And that's another way of thinking about what yoga is. In the Yoga Sutra, is to make the mind placid. And then with a placid mind, you can get in touch with your true nature. Not with a churned up mind. So a lot of the Yoga Sutra is designed to advise us on how to stop the churnings of the mind, the habitual patterns of the mind. And the good news is, I mean, nirodha is a very important word in Indian texts, in both Buddhist and Hindu texts. Nirodha, for the Buddhist-trained people in the room, is what is necessary to achieve nirvana. Achieve nirvana. You don't really achieve nirvana. You stop non-nirvana. No, really. It's a cessation. It's a cessation of that which is blocking the experience of nirvana. And the cessation, you know, in the Buddhist text, as well as in the Yoga Sutra, is a cessation of two main things. Karma and klesha, the two K's. Karma means, you know, the necessity to always feel like we have to do something. In this context, the compulsion that we have to always try and fix things, to always try to improve, to always try and, you know, get to some other state than the one that we're in, to get to some other reality other than the one that we're in, you know, karma, in that sense. And then klesha means mental afflictions. Mental afflictions, they count in the Buddhist text at 84,000. Which is kind of the traditional sort of Sanskritic number for gajillion. We would say gajillion nowadays. Can't count them, there's so many. And then they say, and then there's a few main ones. And we'll go through them. The Yoga Sutra has its own list. Five main problems, main questions, mental afflictions. So how many mental afflictions have you had today, do you think? Yeah, mental affliction is anything that disturbs the placidity, the placidness of the mind. So how many? A couple? Seven? 5,000? Countless? Two? Countless is more like it, okay? Every moment, you know, pretty much, if you do a little mind scan, every moment, we're dissatisfied with something. It's too hot, it's too cold, class is going on too long already, it's not going on long enough. You know, I'm hungry, I'm too full, always something wrong, right? Always dissatisfied. And so the nirodha, the cessation, is to stop that. To stop the constant inner whining. The vrittis, the churnings of the mind, which are mostly whining all the time. And to put a cessation on it. You know, it's a kind of a fancy English word. So just, you know, cessation, but it just means stopping. And stopping then also the karma that forces us to feel like it's not okay. That we have to do something. We have to fix something. See, that's kind of what karma is. The compulsion to act. So when we stop the compulsion to act and the kleshas that kind of force us to have that compulsion, right? When we have mental afflictions, anger, jealousy, pride, we feel like we have to do something. You say, I'm angry, I gotta do something, I gotta yell. You know, I'm angry, right? I'm jealous, that means I gotta do something, you know, fix it. I'm envious, I gotta get what somebody else has. You know, always like motivated by these kleshas, we create this karma, the compulsion to act and therefore acting with that compulsion. Instead of acting spontaneously, freely, you know, happily, and so forth. Feeling like we have to do something. So cessation is a very important concept in the Indian-based religions. And it's good news. I always find it to be very good news that the goal is just to stop doing something. If the goal was a matter of like trying to reach something that I don't have yet, or, you know, construct something, build something, attain something, and so forth, that sounds a lot harder. It just is a matter of stop doing something. You know, just stop the thing that's obstructing the goal. The goal is always present, in other words. Samadhi, moksha, liberation, nirvana is always present as a possibility. But all we need to do is to clear the clouds from the clear blue sky. The clouds are obstructing the clear blue sky. So it's a matter of stopping the cloud machine. You see? It's a matter of stopping that thing that's obstructing us from realizing our true nature. And our true nature is awesome, okay? You know, it's completely happy. It's completely satisfied. It's, you know, at one with the world and with other beings and with the cosmos. Our true nature is awesome, and we all have it, and we all have it equally, and we all have it available at any time. We just need to nirodha. We need to stop. And yoga means stopping the mind, the churnings of the mind that are preventing us from seeing our true nature, from having that that placid, you know, pond. Okay. When that happens, tada drashtuhu svarupa vastanam. When that happens, tada means then, the seer, the drashtu, abides, avastanam means rests in, svarupa. Sva means self, rupa means form, and it's a kind of a common you know, Sanskrit term for your true nature, your true being, your true form. When that happens, the seer here I think means the perceiver. You know how we say that even in English, I get it, I see, you know, you understand or you perceive it properly. So similarly here, the seer, the perceiver, rests in his or her svarupa, in her true nature. When the vrittis stop, when the churnings of the mind stop, and some kind of peace is obtained, right? Then the next verse, vritti sarupyam itarata, itaratra. I think there's a misprint here. You got to add a P. Vritti sarupyam. P is missing there, I think. So, itarata means on the other hand or otherwise. Otherwise means if you don't stop the habitual, you know, kind of patterns of thought, if you don't stop the vrittis, then you identify with them. Vritti sarupya. You take the form of them, kind of literally. You identify with them. Do we ever identify with the stuff that's going on in our minds, you think? Like all the time, right? There's many, many ways that we do. We identify, for example, I mean, most obviously, we identify with our feelings. I am happy, I am sad, I am content, I am, you know, upset, and so forth. We identify also with our mental afflictions. I am angry. I am proud. I am jealous. I am envious. See, otherwise, if you don't stop those vrittis, you will identify with them. You will think that that's who you are. And that's not who you really are. That's the kind of like basic teaching of the Yoga Sutra, is that you are much more than your vrittis. You know, you aren't your vrittis at all, actually. Much, much, you know, kind of like amazing self than that. You know, your true nature, your true self, is not the crap that's going on in your mind. So that's good news too, isn't it? Then he says in the next verse, the stopping, this abhyasa vairagya avyam tan narodha. So again, narodha, the stopping, the cessation of those vrittis. So we skipped a few verses now, but he comes back to this, like, you know, kind of thing about the yoga. Yoga chitta vritti narodaha. The narodaha of those vrittis is brought about through abhyasa and vairagya. I've translated abhyasa as practice, which is the usual translation of abhyasa. It means practice. So, you know, right at the pretty close to the front of the text, he's saying, look, you gotta practice this. This isn't gonna happen in like one class on the Yoga Sutra. Not going to happen in four classes of the Yoga Sutra. It's probably not going to happen in four classes of the Yoga Sutra, even if you do your exercise for a whole week for each class. It might take some time. Abhyasa means practice. And, you know, as I always joke with yoga audiences, there's nothing in the Sanskrit English dictionary when you look up yoga. There's no connotation. There are many connotations to the word yoga. But there's nothing in there that suggests easy. You know, no worries, no sweat. You see, it's a practice. It means discipline. Also, if you wanted to translate yoga with one English word, discipline would not be a bad idea. All kinds of yogas, there's many, many forms of yoga, but they all involve abhyasa. They all involve practice, discipline. So I think there are, you know, we'll go on. He goes on in the text to define each one of these, abhyasa and vairagya. But I just wanted to stop and say, I think practice can mean two very different things at different stages in your spiritual life. early in your spiritual life, and early, by early I mean maybe for the first couple of decades, it means discipline. It means disciplining your actions, it means disciplining your speech, and especially disciplining your mind. And the way to do that is through the three sort of aspects of a practice we talked about earlier. Physical aspect, including ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Learning how to discipline your inclinations. And unfortunately, practically all our inclinations are wrong. Our basic instincts, what we call instincts, are pretty much hardwired wrong. Like, not just a little bit. Like 180 degrees wrong. I'll give you an example. If I were to leap up from this chair and slap you upside the head, what would your instinct be? Your inclination. What would be the first thing that your body wants to do? It's going to slap back, I suggest, right? So, that's just one example of many, many, many. If someone yells at you, what's your inclination? If someone betrays you, what's your inclination? You see, somebody lies to you. Anytime we feel, hurt or attacked or something, we want to return it in kind, right? And all the religious traditions, many of the religious traditions are all over this. This is why Jesus said, turn the other cheek, because that's about the last thing that you want to do when somebody smacks you upside the head. Turn the other, what do you mean, turn the other cheek? Come on. Yeah. So our instincts are wired wrong, most of them. We fortunately have a few good ones. Like the instinct to love other people, the instinct to have compassion for other people's suffering. We have those too. Those should be cultivated. But most of them are negative. Most of them are just reactionary and just recreate the problem that we're trying to solve by striking out like that. Just recreate more problems. If you return violence with violence, hatred with hatred, anger with anger, and so forth, you're just spinning the wheel over and over and over again for more of that to occur. So our instincts are wired wrong. So practice for decades, probably, in most people's case, means practicing disciplining yourself to rewire your instincts. And that occurs not just through ethical behavior, learning to control your body and your speech, but also through meditation and wisdom. Learning why. Wisdom means kind of like learning why I should control my instincts. How's the world working, actually? How's the world going around? Why do I suffer? Why am I having a hard time of life? And wisdom's very much included in all of this. And then meditation means learning how to control your mind. Not just your body and your speech, but even your thoughts. So I'd say, after several decades of abhyasa, of practice like that, then abhyasa, is ready for its next sort of phase, I'd say. And the next phase is to begin to let go of practice, of discipline. Your practice becomes one of practicing freedom. But that can only occur once you can trust yourself to be free. See what I mean? Once you can trust yourself, having disciplined yourself to rewire your instincts. But then, of course, you have to practice freedom. That's the goal. The goal isn't to get really, really good at discipline. The goal is to be able to drop discipline eventually and be free. But you have to be able to trust yourself to be free. We all want to be free, And the idea that most of us have is that, well, I'll be free. I'll be free without discipline. Discipline is, kind of harnessing me in. We will be free through discipline. Okay? It is through discipline that we become free. But eventually we have to be free of discipline too. But that's a sort of second, and usually like much later, for most people in this room, I'd say, much later phase of practice of vyasa. Okay? Then the next one is vairagya. The stopping of these habitual thoughts is brought about through practice and imperturbability. It's a big, kind of clunky English word, I know. Maybe after a couple more years I'll think of a better one that I prefer. But it kind of means not being fazed by stuff. You know? Chillaxed. Okay? In the Sanskrit dictionary, they say in things like indifference. Sanskrit English dictionary. To be indifferent, but that doesn't quite get at it. It sounds like you just don't care about anything. So that's not what vairagya means. Vairagya literally means dispassionate. Dispassionate. Ragya is passion. You know, viragya means dispassionate. So imperturbability, not getting your knickers in a twist about everything. Okay? Not getting your panties in a twist. Chillaxed. So the next kind of verses are actually definitions of these two major concepts in this first chapter, abhyasa and vairagya, practice and imperturbability. Tatra stittau yatro vyasaha. Practice, abhyasa, means yatna. Yatna means making efforts, working. You know. So again, he's not suggesting that you slough off, especially. And by the way, even in the second phase, remember the two phases of practice I just talked about. First phase is, you know, hardcore discipline. The second phase also involves yatna, also involves effort, because we're very, very used to not being free. You see, it takes effort to learn how to be free. It takes effort to be able to, like, shed the shackles that we're so accustomed to. You know, we're all in prison cells of our own making, and the prison door has always been open. But we have been busy decorating the cell in there. You know, putting up little pictures and, you know, maybe like little doilies on the armchair, you know, inside the prison cell. And, you know, and then somebody says, well, the door is open, just walk out. I said, no, I got my doilies on my arm. I like it here. So practice in both its phases will entail yatna, effort, making efforts in doing what? And then there's a lot of different understandings of this phrase, you know, tatra stittau. Stittau means being present. And it's in a locative case, which means, so being in the present, tatra, there. So, you know, my understanding of this sutra is staying present in the here and now. That's what real practice is. Keeping your mind focused on what's happening in reality, because reality unfolds in the here and now, right? It doesn't unfold later, you know, in the future, and it doesn't unfold in the past. The past is over. Future hasn't come yet. So this is a very kind of cool way of thinking about what practice really means, I think. It means staying focused on what you're doing in the here and now. And, you know, maybe what you're doing is meditating. Maybe what you're doing is asana practice. Maybe what you're doing is going to your work, going to the job. Maybe what you're doing is interacting with your family, which is a great practice. Ram Dass once said, you know, I'll know who Ram Dass is. Ram Dass once said, if you think that you're enlightened, go home to your family for a weekend. See how well that works out for you enlightened, you know, sort of advanced practitioner. That's hard, right? There's lots of vrittis involved in family life. You know, habitual patterns of thought and action. Oh my God. It's like going into a rut every time you go home, isn't it? Yeah, everyone like assumes the same role that they've always played for 40, 50, 60 years. You know, sister does this, daddy says this, mom does it, you know. Everyone just assumes the same roles over and over and over again. And so forth. Practice means making efforts in staying present. And the purpose of a spiritual life is to stay present. It's not to, like, zip off into never-never land. Or, you know, transcend to some, like, you know, some space that's up there by Alpha Centauri, you know, just left, take a left on the freeway, and you get to, like, some other place where nirvana is going to happen, or, you know, enlightenment, or, you know, liberation. It's to be present fully in the here and now. Okay? To accept reality as it is, but to understand reality as it is, too. So, we'll get there. It will be firmly grounded. What's that? It. Abhyasa. Talking about practice here. It will be firmly grounded when it has been done steadily over a long period of time, dirgha kala, for a long time, Okay, so it's like already like factored in decades here when it comes to abhyasa. So yeah, a lot of people enter a spiritual life of all sorts, and they say, "Yeah, oh, it's so cool. You know, I'm going to be spiritual now, and you know, I'm going to go home and start meditation. I'll start yoga practice. I'll start like watching my ethics and so forth." And then like, you know, 2 months go by and they come and complain. "Well, nothing's changed in my life. It's not working." It's like 2 months, man. You know, come on. Dirgha Kala means you gotta work at it for a long time. You gotta practice it for a long time. And of course you'll see results. But not instantaneously. I once had a psychiatrist, you know, I had a major bout of depression, and I had a psychiatrist, and I, you know, I asked him, like, "You know, I'm in a hurry here. How long is this going to take, you know, to fix me, you know?" And he says, "Well, you spent your whole life getting this screwed up. It's going to take a little while to, you know, unscrew you, you know?" And, you know, from a sort of ancient Indian point of view, you took lifetimes to get as, like, messed up as you are. Dirgha Kala is going to take a little while to, you know, kind of undo the mess. So over a long period of time, skillfully, sakkara. Sakkara literally means carefully or attentively. Paying attention to your practice, you know? And learning it properly also. It kind of entails that. Learning a practice properly. Not just kind of like making it up on your own. But learning from a, you know, again, an authoritative source, which means a source that you can trust to be efficacious, to actually work. And then to try your best to put it into practice. But a lot of people, you know, get the idea, "Well, I'll learn a little bit here, a little bit there, and then I'll kind of like make stuff up that fits me in your spiritual practice." How's that worked out so far, you know, in your life? Of just kind of trying to, you know, find your own way, making it up as you go along, see? There's a reason why there are these, you know, traditions. It's because, you know, it's tried and true. It's been test-driven by others, and it's worked. That's why these, you know, texts are preserved. It's because it works. So that's satkara. And then assiduously, asevita. You know, very, very, with a lot of effort, with a lot of attention, and over a long period of time. That's practice. So it, you know, if you're entering a spiritual life of whatever sort, you should regard it as a marathon and not a sprint. Be in it for the long run. And there will be ups and downs. I guarantee that, 100%. It won't all just go smooth, and it won't all just keep going up on a nice, even path, you know, a plane like that, until you're, you know, finally happy. They'll be like more like this, you know. The graph is very strange in a spiritual life. But the point here is you've got to stick with it. You've got to have that kind of determination and perseverance with a spiritual life. Just like with any other skill, you know. You're not going to learn the saxophone overnight. You're not going to all of a sudden pick up the saxophone and 5 days later play like John Coltrane. You got to practice, right? And the spiritual life is just like that. Meditation is just like that. All aspects of the spiritual life are just like that. Fighting your mental afflictions is certainly like that. You know, trying to overcome your worst inclinations, your anger, your pride, your jealousy, your envy, etc. It takes time. And you'll lose a lot of rounds in the boxing match, you know? And then you go back to your corner and like have the trainer like stitch you up a little bit. And probably go back to the gym. You'll ask to, you know, for a little break in the action and go back to the gym and work out some more. This is all a metaphor, right? Follow me? And then you go back and try it again, you know, over and over and over again. You have to factor in failure. You just have to factor in failure. It's, you know, in American baseball, you are a really good hitter if you get on base 1 out of 3 times, right? That's a really a star baseball player. And an ordinary baseball player gets on base like 1 out of 4 times. I would say you're doing very, very good in a spiritual life if you get 1 out of 10, maybe. I mean, not really. I mean, to fulfill your ideals, you know, of yourself, the ideals of yourself that you hold in yourself, like 1 out of 10 times, it's not bad. But the other 9 times are crucial. The other 9 times are learning, you know. Learning, you know, your limitations, learning what you need to work on, learning what you can do now and what maybe you need more practice on for later and so forth. So, you know, that's practice. Imperturbability, vairagya, is said to be mastered when there is no craving. Vitrsna, trsna, very important word in especially Buddhist texts. I'll come back to it. Imperturbability is said to be mastered when there is no craving for anything, either what you have directly experienced, drishta, drishta means you've seen it directly, or what you have just heard about, anushravaka, anushravaka, what you just heard about. So this is the definition of vairagya, and it says that vairagya leads, when it becomes mastered, when imperturbability is mastered, it leads to no craving. Vitrsna. Some of you may know that in the Buddhist texts, craving is identified in the early texts, especially the Pali texts, as the source of suffering. The first noble truth that the Buddha said is life is suffering. The second truth is, and suffering has a cause, and it is trsna. Craving. Always wanting something you don't have. And, or you could say the negation of that too. The negative version of that, rather, is not wanting what I do have. Two forms of dissatisfaction. So imperturbability, chillaxedness. Maybe that would be a better translation. Chillaxedness leads to this satisfaction, to the opposite of craving. The opposite of craving is contentment. Which is in the Yoga Sutra also. The word santosha means contentment. So vairagya leads to contentment. And then, what should I be content with? And then he says, well, everything. Whether it's something that you've directly experienced, well, I just saw the new iPhone 5. You know, I went to the Apple store and I saw the new iPhone 5, I saw it directly. Or you just heard about it. I haven't seen the iPhone 5S, but I've heard people talking about the iPhone 5S and I want it. See, whether it's a direct experience that stimulates the craving, or just the word of mouth, kind of. What you've heard about, what you read about, and so forth. So the end of craving. For others, so now that I skipped a bunch of verses here where he goes into, you know, kind of like the deeper understandings of imperturbability, including the notion that some people will achieve the final state of this only after dropping their body, only after, like, dying. So then he returns to it, and then he says, and for others, which seems to mean, like, people who still have a body, the way to achieve it is through these five kind of virtues. This is one of the several places in the Yoga Sutra where he outlines a kind of a path. The most famous of which is the eight angas, the eightfold path of yoga. But here's another one, and there's yet another one in the second chapter, first verse, defining kriya yoga. Anyway. For others, there must first be shraddha. Shraddha means faith or confidence. Virya, joyful effort, working hard. Smriti, I've translated it as mindfulness. It literally means remembering. Smriti. Samadhi, full integration. And prajna, wisdom. So what is confidence? What is shraddha? You know, oftentimes this verse this word is translated as faith. But then immediately when people hear the English word faith, they put an adjective in front of it. Which is what? Blind. Blind faith. Well, I guess not immediately. for everyone. And it doesn't mean that. it doesn't mean just like I'll believe whatever, you know, without thinking about it, or what if Guruji says so, I'll just believe it, or something like that. So I prefer the translation confidence, because confidence is what you get when you put it into practice and it starts to see the results. When you start a practice, when you start a meditative practice, when you start a spiritual practice, when you start trying to sort of systematically to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem in life, you know, if you stick with it, abhyasa, if you have abhyasa, you will see results. And then you get your stoke up, you see. Until then, it's kind of hard, really. So there is, I think, a place for blind faith, in a way. You just kind of like have to have some faith that even though I haven't seen any results, that I haven't even started yet, that I could see results if I did start, and then you persevere, you see. But until you start seeing the results, you don't really have any idea that it's for sure. That it's going to work. So no confidence. So this word kind of can go both ways. Faith means that, you know, you have to have the shraddha to even start, right? To even say, well, this program outlined in the Yoga Sutra or whatever seems like it could work for me. But then the confidence, the second sort of aspect of shraddha, comes into play after, you know, 4, 5, 6 months go by, of abhyasa, of practice. And, you know, it's kind of guaranteed or your money back to work, but it requires you to actually do it. And that's the problem for all of us, isn't it? The problem is actually getting our butts to the cushion and doing our meditation. The problem is actually resisting, you know, these kinds of inclinations that we have to return hatred with hatred and anger and with anger and so forth. It requires work. It requires discipline. But if that discipline is in place, then Dirghakala is a relative term, you know, long time, you know, within a relatively short time of assiduous practice, of really doing it on a daily basis, it means, you will see results. Your life starts to change. Your perceptions of yourself and others and the reality around you start to change. So you get that shraddha. Then with that confidence, virya, then you really get your stoke up. Virya means, you know, energetic effort. You say, well, if a little bit of, like, you know, half an hour a day of practice can make this kind of difference in 3, 4, 5, 6 months, what if I really got my back behind it, you know? What if I really started to put some major effort in? What if I started putting the kind of effort into my spiritual life that I put into my job, for example? My profession, making money, you know, achieving higher status. We put a lot of effort into things like that, don't we? What if I put even like maybe a third of that effort into my spiritual life? You know, then you get some supercharge behind it, virya. And virya also, you know, usually entails, and you do it joyfully, you know. So I use that kind of surfer term, get your stoke up, you know. Because stoke means that, you know, in surfer lingo. It means that you work hard, you paddle your ass off, and you're really happy about it. You're stoked. Stoke means like I'm really, you know, happy to be working hard for something that I think is going to really pay off. So that's the virya part. Then mindfulness, smriti. It means to remember. Mindfulness means, in this context, I think, remembering what it's all about in your life now, okay? So you've gotten your practice going, you've gotten some results from it, you've gotten this kind of energy that has supercharged your practice, and then part of the practice is not forgetting what you're doing with your life now. You see, reminding yourself, like little string around the finger, okay, smriti. Then samadhi, as I said, full integration. And we'll talk a lot more about samadhi in future classes in this course. But again, it seems to me that samadhi has a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of different understandings of samadhi. Samadhi can, you know, be understood as a kind of a very, very high spiritual state of mind that you get through deep meditation and stuff like that. And I can't definitely mean that too. But it's the literal meaning of samadhi is that you put things together. Samadhi, from the root da, means to put or place. So you're putting it together. You're putting you together with your life. You're integrating with the life that you're living on a moment-to-moment basis. Because that is the life that you're leading. It happens moment to moment, right? So instead of spacing out, or instead of wishing you were different, or thinking about the future, or reminiscing about the past all the time, you're fully present in the moment, samadhi. And then prajna, wisdom. We'll talk again more about wisdom in the later verses of the Yoga Sutra, but it really means understanding that the way things appear are not as they are. So I'll just give you one example of that. Does this object appear to be a changing thing or an unchanging? Does it appear to be a changing thing or an unchanging thing?
Unchanging.
Doesn't it? It's got some legs here. It's not, you know, it's holding the coffee pretty well. Right? Not changing. So it appears, and a lot of things appear as they, you know, most things actually appear to us as if they were unchanging. But we know with a little wisdom, you don't need much wisdom to get this understanding, that this is a changing, right? So, you know, we understand that someday, this is plastic, so I don't know what happens to plastic over time, you know, but it'll definitely change, there'll be holes in it, and it'll get sharded, and then whatever happens to plastic over the course of hundreds of years will happen, right? But is it changing moment to moment? You know, that's change over a long time, and we can get our heads around that pretty well. But doesn't change happen moment to moment, if you think about it? Yes? It doesn't stay the same, it's change a little bit. Stay the same, change a little bit, right? That's not how change occurs. It's changing moment to moment, nanosecond by nanosecond, actually, right? In fact, this is such a changing thing that you could say that it's not even a thing. The change is occurring at such a rapid rate. I have a student who looked it up once on the internet, found some site that said scientists now are estimating that change in objects occur at the rate of 3 trillion times a second. 3 trillion. I mean, you can't even imagine what trillion is, let alone three of them. Let alone per second. How could it be changing that fast? How could I be holding it if it were changing 3 trillion times a second? You see, things are not what they appear to be. You know? That's what our modern scientists say. It's indeterminate whether this is actually matter or just energy. That's what they say, right? You could go either way. You could, like, regard it as matter, but if you're going to regard it as matter, you've got to regard it as matter changing at the rate of 3 trillion times a second. Or you could just say it's just energy. Does it look like just energy? Does it look like it's changing 3 trillion times a second? See? We're deceived. Our minds deceive us. So wisdom is kind of like getting there, getting some understanding that the way things appear are not as they are, cannot be as they are. So those are the five. And then he says in this next verse, a couple. Ishvara pranidhanat va. Or you can get there through surrendering to Ishvara, the Lord. And, you know, the Yoga Sutra at certain crucial points becomes a text of devotion. Of bhakti, what they call bhakti. Bhakti yoga. Like in the Yoga Sutra, in the Bhagavad Gita, the discipline of devotion. And devotion here to Ishvara. Ishvara means, it's kind of interesting that he picked that term. He didn't use Vishnu. He didn't use Shiva. He didn't use, you know, Mother Goddess. He said just, you know, the Lord. So it could be any Lord, you see. Could be God. It could be, you know, whatever, however you conceive of God. What is it in AA they say? The higher power. So Ishvara kind of is functioning like that, here. Surrendering to a higher power. And that's a matter of giving up the idea that you can do it yourself. See? So built into this notion of devotion, surrendering, you know, parinadana, 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 Paridhana sutta. Parinidhana, isn't it? Yeah. Nidhana. Pragnidhana sutta. With that idea of surrendering is also the idea of grace. Grace. That if you surrender to the higher power, the grace of God will bless you. That you'll get the strength from the higher power that you never had personally. That you say your name to yourself don't have. So very interesting. He throws it in at certain critical points. I'll show you another one later. Where he says, look, you know, you can do all of this abhyasa, and, you know, all of this kind of personal practice, and, you know, think that you can develop yourself and so forth. And you can, but it's hard. Va, he says, you know, in this one, or you could just give it up to God. Just surrender to a higher power and let the power work through you. Then in this next verse he goes in, verse 130, he talks about the obstacles, the mental obstacles, antaraya, the problems, the obstacles, the difficulties that you'll face. And I was looking through this again, and I think I probably should have added another word, because a word that I didn't translate here is citta vikshepa, which means the mental obstacles that distract the mind. So you can just kind of add that into your translation. The mental obstacles that distract the mind, the citta. And then he gives the laundry list. Sickness, rigidity, you know, rigidity of thought, fundamentalism, you could say. Doubt, big obstacle. You know, I don't know, sounds pretty good, but I don't know. All the time, I don't know, and you never get around to it. Because you have this doubt. Carelessness, not paying attention. Alasya, laziness, just not feeling like it. That ever occurred to you? Ever happened to you? Oh yeah, I'd like to meditate, but just don't feel like it today. Like to fight my anger, but you know, it's so hard. I can't. Intemperance, wrong views, vranti darshana, thinking that things exist in ways that they don't, you know, is a kind of a one major form of wrong view, or thinking that you'll get results from a path that won't bring those results. And there are plenty of them around, especially in the modern spiritual, you know, marketplace of like paths that just aren't going to go anywhere. I'm not going to diss any of them right now. Failing to make progress and not sticking with it. So again, they're kind of like a laundry list of all these kinds of obstacles that we face. And then in the next verse he says, Pratishedartam ekatva abhyasa. There's one abhyasa, eka. There's one abhyasa, practice, that has as its artam, its purpose, to overcome them, pratisheda, to provide an antidote to the obstacles. And then again, one of the most important verses. Maitri karuna mudita upekshanam sukha dukkha punya punya vishayanam bhavanatash chitta prasadanam. The mind, the chitta, becomes prasada, chilled out, calm, placid, with the practice of maitri, loving kindness. In Pali, it's metta. Some of you may have heard that term. Some you know, practitioners and Vipassana practitioners, they always like end their emails with metta. You know, loving kindness, maitri. It comes from a word in Sanskrit that means friend, mitra. So maitri you could also translate as friendliness, which is not a bad translation. But the usual translation is loving kindness. Karuna. Karuna means compassion. The caring about the suffering of others. See, compassion. Mudita, joy, taking celebration. The celebration of the happiness of others, Or you could even say, mudita, the celebration of life itself. Being joyful about life. And then equanimity, upeksha. Upeksha means literally to look over. Upapeksha, to look over. So we say in English, overlooking differences. Upeksha, equanimity. Equanimity. Which means that you overlook the differences between people. You don't say, well, I like you, but I, you know, hate you. You say, like everyone in some sense or another, you know. Wish everyone the same, you know, loving kindness, compassion, joy, equally. But it also means, you know, as it says in the verse, equanimity towards all things and beings, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. You know, whether things are going right for you or not. And whether things are punya apunya. Good or bad. So another way of thinking about it, these are called the four immeasurables in Buddhism. Or in the Hindu tradition, they call them the four Brahma Viharas, the abodes of God, the stations of the deity. These are very famous. This quartet is very famous in ancient Indian literature. Maitri, loving kindness, wishing other people would be happy. Loving kindness. Compassion, wishing that they didn't suffer. See, having compassion for their suffering. Joy, wishing them the highest happiness. That's another way of understanding mudita. Wishing them the highest happiness. Or celebrating life as a whole. I kind of like that understanding of mudita. And then equanimity, not getting rattled, not going up and down all the time, you know? Depending on whether things are going your way or not, whether the circumstances are favorable or seeming unfavorable, whether it's easy or difficult. But accepting life as it is, as it's unfolding. Right? And it won't always unfold your way, have you noticed? Yeah. You can't know what wave is coming in next. Right? Some ways will be pleasant, some ways will be difficult and challenging. And equanimity, upeksha, means like, you surf whatever wave comes your way. Whether you want it or not, whether you like it or not, you deal. You deal with reality as it is, as it's unfolding. And don't hold out hope that someday you'll make a wave machine where every wave will be exactly the same and predictable. See, some people get this idea as the goal of a spiritual life is to just be able to control everything. And, and predict everything. So no surprises. What kind of interesting, if you're going to have like a spiritual goal, at least have one that's interesting. That spiritual goal is completely uninteresting. Imagine if you could, first of all, you won't be able to. Alright? So, never mind. That goal is not going to happen for you. But secondly, why would you even want it? There would be no surprise, there wouldn't be any shocks either, for that matter. Okay? Nothing shocked, no negative surprises. But there wouldn't be any joy in life either. You know, oh, I knew that was going to happen. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew that one. Oh, yeah, I knew you were going to say that. You know, I knew you were going to do that. I already knew that. Why would you want to have a goal like that, you see? The goal, a much better goal and a much more plausible goal is not to create a wave machine, but to learn how to surf happily any wave that comes your way with equanimity, with chillaxedness, placidness. Then the last couple of verses, we're getting there, don't worry, for this class anyway. Among those special people, Abhijata means those who are well-born, literally. High-born person. Among those special people whose vrittis, habitual patterns of thought, have kshina. Kshina means dwindled, gotten smaller, diminished. There is a balanced consciousness, samapati. Samapati is one of the gajillions of words, not gajillions, but many words in Sanskrit that could be translated meditation. But, literally it means that things have fallen together equally. Samapati. So a balanced consciousness, which like a jewel, like a mani, like in Om Mani Padme Hum, yeah, Padma Hum. So like a jewel, reflects its object, whether it be the perceiver, the grahitar, the perceived, the grahya, or the perceiving, grahana, steadily and clearly. This is one of the big verses in the Yoga Sutra that really is pointing at wisdom, and it's not an easy verse to understand. It's complex there a little bit. So unfortunately it's happening towards the end of class where everyone's attention is a little diminished. So just work hard at this for just a few minutes, okay? What he seems to be saying here is that a special person, a person who has abhyasad for a long time, practiced for a long time, who has done those like five practices of, you know, having confidence, having joyful effort, and so forth, samadhi, who've reached some kind of samadhi, you know, like that, that their vrittis begin to diminish. The churnings of the mind calm down. And when the churnings of the mind calm down, there is a recognition of how the mind is actually working. And I'll just explain this in my own words, and then you can look back at the verse and see if it makes sense to you. There is a recognition that there is no mind, actually. Okay? That the mind exists dependently on what the mind thinks. A thought, in other words. There's no thinker without a thinker thinking a thought. And there's no thought that's just free-floating there without a thinker thinking it. That these three things, the subject, the object, and the interaction between them, all exist interdependently, and none of them can exist independently. So the example here is the grasper, the perceiver. There is no perceiver until and unless there's something perceived. Right? There's not a thinker unless there's a thought that's thunk. There's no seer, visual, right? Seer, until and unless the seer sees a visual object. You can't say I'm a seer unless you've seen something. Right? I'm a seer, I don't see nothing. I'm a seer, but I don't see. That can't be, right? Impossible. So a seer exists dependently on a visible object, but the visible object also exists depending on the seer who sees it. There is no visible object until and unless it's seen by a seer. What would it mean to say that there was a visible object that wasn't seen? It would be an invisible visible object. Right? Not seen means invisible. Okay? So there's no sound, there's no hearer until and unless there's a sound that the hearer hears. And there's no audible sound until and unless there's a hearer hearing the audible sound. And neither one of them can exist without the hearing. That links them, right? That links the hearer with the audible sound. So this is, for those of you who study some Buddhism, this is the emptiness of the three spheres, what they call the emptiness of the three spheres. And you can run this in any way you want, all day long. Okay? This is how things do exist. They exist interdependently and not independently. There's no feeler until and unless there's a tangible object that the feeler feels. And there's no tangible object unless there's a feeler feeling it. It becomes tangible when the feeler feels it. And there's no tangible object or feeler unless there's a feeling, the action of feeling. So each one, perceiver, the thing perceived, and the perceiving, each one are empty of existing independently. No one of the three can exist on their own. Right? They all need each other. And none of them can come first. That's the kind of kicker. None of them can come first. They all have to arise at the same time. They all have to exist each one of them has to exist for the others to exist. Okay? So the next verse says, in such a case, if you get that, the balanced consciousness that still is conceptual, sa-vitarka, still thinks in concepts. The balance, the samapati, that is still conceptual, confuses words, meanings, and concepts that come from knowledge. So we are constantly confused by our concepts and our words. We think our words refer to things. You see, like coffee cup refers to something. But if the thing is moving at the rate of 3 trillion times a second, in what sense is it a thing? We have a word for it. But in what sense does our word refer to a thing? We have a concept for it. But in what sense does our concept and our words match the thing that we think that they're referring to? I'll give you another example. Is there a river here somewhere? What's it called? Colorado, right? Is the Colorado River a thing or a process? The thing, you think? Does it change? How often does it change? Does the river run? We say the river runs, right? Is the river running? But we have the name for it, river, Colorado River. And with our name, we immediately have a concept of a static thing, right? Of something, a static thing. So our words, our language, you know, kind of create these concepts in us that do not match the entities that we think that they're referring to. Which are all, not just the river, by the way. Everything is in the process of constant change. But because of our words and our concepts, we are deceived in our own minds to think that they're not changing. And then he finally talks about another kind of samapati. When memory is purified, a non-conceptual state of mind appears. Non-conceptual. No concepts. No words. No words. A non-conceptual state of mind appears, which is empty of having any self-nature. Svarupa-shunya. Svarupa-shunya. And which focuses on only itself as the object of thought. So it's 7:05, people are tired, and I'll start the next class with this verse. Because it's pretty important. So we can all take a little break now. I want a full hour for everyone, right? Yeah. So we'll start again at 8:05 for those of you who want to continue. Okay. Yeah.